Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another podcast for Beyond the Mekong, a series broadcast by The Diplomat. And with me today is Am and Steve Sanford, who have worked together for 20 or 30 years as a couple in film, documentaries and as journalists. Am, Steve, welcome to the program.
Yeah, nice to hear from you, Luke.
Okay, you've got a new book out.
Nice to hear from you.
You've got a new book out, Witness to Genocide, Chasing the Rohingya Crisis in Southeast Asia, which you began working on back in 2009. Take us back to the start, back to 2009, when you both really started to follow this story intensely. And what is it about the Rohingya? They lurch from one crisis to another. It's a perennial problem and just doesn't seem to get resolved.
Yeah, thanks, Luke. Well, Em and I, up until 2009, we were primarily covering the Myanmar conflict in eastern Myanmar with the Karen and the Shan groups, ethnic armed groups that were fighting against the junta. In 2009, there was a posting on the South China Morning Post, a story that had pictures of South Asian men lying on a beach in southern Thailand, and they were being watched by what looked to be Thai security forces.
Mm-hmm.
So that stoked our attention, and we were working at the time with Al Jazeera, a correspondent, Selena Downs. So we called her up, and we discussed the situation and decided to head south to find out what was going on. From there, we were able to talk to contacts, and eventually another boat was sighted, a trafficking boat, the Navy intercepted, and we documented that find in January.
Right, that was in 2009.
Yes.
Okay.
And then just give you some background before that, why we so keen about the traffickers, because before 2009, we have been covering the trafficker situation in Mesot at the border of Myanmar in Melwadi.
Right.
For a long time. And we went to the Islamic community in Mesot. And at that time, we didn't know about the name of the Rohingya at all. The local people tell us they are from Bangladesh. So we walk around the community and talk to the village chief. And they told us the situation in the Islamic community is mixed with all the many trafficker, smuggler come from Bangladesh, come from Myanmar, or kept inside the community. So that's why we try to find more story that connected to the traffickers until we heard a lot of South Asian men from Burma, from Bangladesh in Ranong area. So we all went there. First, we have no contact at all. Ranong is quite like, it's just the first time that we cover a story in Ranong. So we talk to many people who work around the Ranong area and the port, and then until we find someone who just come from Chiang Rai, and he's a Muslim from Chiang Rai and live in one of the islands between Thai and Myanmar border. Yes,
yep.
So that's why we just came to cover on the traffickers.
Right.
Okay.
So we didn't know at the time, but it was an ongoing problem, and the Rohingya Muslim population, basically in Western Myanmar, had been persecuted for decades, dating back to at least the 1970s, when there were massive expulsions of the minority group, and a lot of them would flee across the border into Bangladesh. So the mistreatment of this group over the decades caused a lot of people to seek escape to a third country, or in this case, Malaysia or Indonesia, where they are predominantly Muslim countries.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have to travel through Thai waters, and occasionally they would be intercepted by security forces in Thailand. Now, as we later found out, there was a policy by the Thai Navy that was basically called the help on or push back policy. Now, in that process, they would either steer them in the right direction, resupply them with food and water and, you know, rice and that sort of thing, and then help them, guide them on to their destination. Or in some cases, they would take them out to sea and push them back to where they had once come from.
Right.
So in this instance, when a Thai boat of the Thai Navy spotted a trafficking boat, we found out about the situation, and went to the dock area around midnight. It was in January of 2009. And we documented the case. And it was quite a horrid scene. There was a group of Asian men primarily that were starving. It was very rough conditions. They had been out to sea for a long period of time in their journey to try to get to Thailand or Malaysia. And there were Thai medics on the docks helping them out and giving them medical care. And then they basically took them, hauled them off to an immigration center and a hospital that night. So we were able to document that case. And the next morning, the group of the exiles or the migrants, they were hauled into the provincial courthouse. So it was quite an amazing sight. A lot of them were bandaged up. They had barely slept 3 or 4 hours since the boat had come into the docks.
Yep.
Yeah, it was quite a sight to see. It was quite disturbing.
Now, in your book, Witness to Genocide, you go into some graphic details about the plight of those refugees stroke asylum seekers and the torture that was inflicted upon some of them by the authorities, quite horrendous. And these days, I think people are becoming fatigued with stories about Rohingyas who have been mistreated, but it goes back a long way. And the fate that was meted out to them back then really was quite extraordinary.
Yes, that's correct, Luke. It was quite disturbing when we talked to some of the boat people that had come into the dock area. One of them in particular was yelling out that he wanted to tell a story. And when we came up to him, we saw this very nasty gash on the underside of his leg. We asked him what had happened. It was a massive wound. Half of his leg was gone on the underthigh.
I saw the photos.
And he said, yeah, we were able to take photos of it and... Basically, what he said was the Myanmar Navy had held them down and taken a long stick with a gauze wrapped around the end, dipped it in diesel, and lit it on fire, and then pressed it against his leg. They were torturing him. So he had a massive burn on the underside of his leg.
Mm-hmm.
So we took photos of that, and we contacted Dr. Porntip, who is a forensic expert in Thailand.
And quite renowned.
And she came down.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I just said, and she's quite renowned.
Yeah. So we called Dr. Porntip. We contacted her by email that night after we went back to our hotel to do the edit. And she agreed to come down to take a look at this boat passenger's leg to verify whether or not his story held up. As it turned out, she came down 2 days later with a small group of delegates from Bangkok. And she examined the young man's leg and said, yes, in fact, that seemed to be collaborating with his story that he had been tortured by the Myanmar Navy.
Yeah. So we communicate with the boat people, with one guy among them speak Thai and Rohingya. So he'd be able to translate for me. So when we try to interview with the victims, with the young man who got very bad wounded, so he just tell us, like, the Burmese man in the uniform, in the wrap of the oil rag, and then torture him. And when he tried to act or, you know, cry for help, they keep beating him. So that's according to Mahmoud, our translator, who among the Rohingya on that boat, tell us. And then amazingly, they remember the number on the boat, the Myanmar Navy boat. So they tell us the Burmese Navy boat number was 425-423. So they wrote it somehow on the hand, you know, because they want to memorize everything what had happened to them along the journey.
Right.
It was just a start for you guys that would take you through to 2017 and the Great Exodus and, I have to say, alleged genocide, although we all know what happened. That 8-year period, it must have been quite stunning to follow the plight of this group of people who were not that well known in the outside world, yet they were enduring such deep atrocities. And I must quickly add, the animosity I've found towards the Rohingya in Burma, in Myanmar, is quite something else.
Yeah, I think that's correct. All of the ethnic groups within Myanmar, as you know, are under attack in some form. by the Burmese junta. But the Rohingya Muslim group in particularly seem to be, well, they've been classified by someone in the UN as the most persecuted minority on the planet. So
right.
it's a very difficult situation that they face. And in 2017, there was a massive exodus after the Myanmar army started a clearance operation. Now, this clearance operation was based on reports that a number of police posts had been attacked by a rebel Rohingya group called ARSA. Now, to be able to verify that by asking the Burmese army would be difficult because they've been proven again and again to be liars. You can't trust what they say. But in any event, the disproportionate response was atrocious.
Right.
The Burmese army began a clearance operation after these reported attacks on a number of police outposts. I think there was 30 of them, as they claimed. Now, after this incident, I guess we could go back a day before the clearance operation began, if you don't mind.
Sure.
On August 24th, a Kofi Annan-led commission presented a report talking about rehabilitation, reconciliation, the Rohingya people, because the year previous there had been a smaller operation that had occurred, a clearance operation. And there were many atrocities committed at that time as well. So this commission, the Kofi Annan Commission, were basically outlining a process in which there could be some reconciliation and peace between the Rohingya Muslim minority and the Buddhist majority population. Unfortunately, a massive army clearance began the next day, and that led to more than 750,000 people fleeing for their lives across the border into Bangladesh.
Can I stop a little bit?
Sure.
So after Kofi Annan gave So on that night, a few hours after Kofi Annan had recommendation.
Well, it was early the next morning.
Yeah, 10 o'clock.
Yeah, so as you know, it's very difficult to report from the conflict zone if you're not there.
Indeed,
and in this case, the Burmese army disallowed any foreigners from going into the area to report. So we were very frustrated at that time. It's in our book. We were investigating the situation from the capital, which was not in the area of conflict, a place called Sitwe. Now, during that time, we went to some IDP camps where the Buddhist population had been transferred to from the conflict zone. And they told us that early in the morning they heard gunshots, noises, but they never saw anybody. They never saw any of the so-called Rohingya terrorists coming into their area. But they heard gunshots, they heard noises, and then the next day the Burmese army came to their door and said, you have to leave. It's very dangerous in this neighborhood. We're going to have to relocate you for some time. So that in itself was very suspicious in trying to figure out what exactly was going on. Where were these terrorists? Where were these people? All we could rely on were the accounts of the Burmese army. As I mentioned earlier, it wasn't very...
accurate?
Very accurate. That's an understatement. Yes. Yeah, they weren't very accurate. But within a week, we had already left the area, and we were in another part of the country in Burma. We were actually doing a short story on the coal pollution in the area, coal mining in Shan State, which is in eastern Myanmar. We got a call. We got a call from our colleague who said that the government was now allowing press tours of the conflict zone. Now, that sounded great, but there were a few stipulations involved. First, they only allowed one person per media group.
Right.
And second, you could not bring a translator. So that was a bit of a difficulty. You know, if you can't talk to the witnesses, then it's going to be a problem.
But one would assume that you would be relying on the military to provide the translations as well.
That's spot on. Exactly. And there was, as we found out, I managed to get up to the area of Sitwe, the capital, and then I met up with a group of Burmese journalists as well as some foreign journalists, including Jonathan Head from BBC and Mei Wong from the CNA,
yep,
and several others. And we went up the river to the area where the conflict was, heading up to Munga. And we were assisted with an army-sponsored translator, and that was it, one person. So it was very difficult to try to communicate.
Yep.
Now, on the first day of our two-day press tour, we went to a IDP center. It was a school where a group of Hindu villagers had been relocated after their villages had reportedly been burnt down by ARSA terrorists.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah. Yeah, go on, sorry.
During our time, we had about 40 minutes at this IDP center. It was a school converted to a temporary displacement center. The army presented us witnesses that we could talk to, and then we would have a translator, the military translator, translate for us. And one of the women said that she had seen firsthand Rohingya terrorists come into the village, and they said, telling the Hindu villagers to get out, and they were going to burn the villages. And basically, what happened, within 24 to 48 hours, it was proven that she was actually in one of the photos that the police presented to us, saying that they had photos of ARSA terrorists burning the Hindu village.
Yeah.
So basically, we were talking to a fake witness, and basically, she had not changed her dress. She had just covered her face up. There were pictures of her burning huts in this Hindu village. So that was that was a bit of a shocker.
Right.
The Burmese journalists, they were quick to pick up on that. And within 2 days, they had found out. They traced the pictures. They looked at the pictures of the witnesses in the school that we had talked to and made the connection. This was not right. So that was the first of two glaring situations where we saw that the Burmese army was deceiving us.
That was actually during a relative period of peace in Myanmar, which was tipped back into civil war in early 2021 after the military ousted the elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi. But in the last 12 months, we're hearing a lot of stories coming out of Rakhine State. And again, it's the persecution of the Rohingya. They occupy the land through which the Chinese oil and gas pipelines run. There's a lot of disputes with the Arakan. The Arakan army is being blamed for atrocities alongside the military. How do you see the situation unfolding now, given your background on this subject?
It's tricky. It's a very murky picture, I guess you could say, because there are so many parties involved and things have changed somewhat.
Yep.
I mean, now the Burmese army is forcing conscription with people across the country, young men, including the Rohingya population, which...
It's kind of strange, isn't it?
Years ago, that they were killed, slaughtering their families.
Right, and they don't even recognize the Rohingya as legitimate citizens of Myanmar and keep claiming that they're Banglas, yet they're conscripting them into their military.
Yeah, that's a great point, Lou. They're not even classified as citizens of Myanmar since 1982, since the consensus said that there was only 135 different ethnic groups within the country, not including the Rohingya. So that in itself is amazing that these things are happening. It's almost like the genocide in 2017. It didn't affect them, but of course it did. And the other thing is that the Arakan army now, I can understand being the second poorest state in the country, that now they have like a major oil and gas pipeline running from the coast in their state up to Kunming in China, with China being the customer.
Right.
So the amount of money that is going to be made by a small group of Burmese army families who originally signed these contracts back in the early 2000s, I think that would get a lot of people upset in Arakan State. And the project is a 30-year gas and oil pipeline project, and it's estimated to be somewhere in the area of $50 billion over 30 years. That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money.
And I can understand any groups that would be furious with that situation if the if the state itself wasn't receiving any of the payment or being affected by it in a positive way. So that's a glaring problem, I think, in the country, is the lack of infrastructure.
We were talking before we started recording, and I think you were saying that with the oil and gas pipeline comes development. Mm. As development is stretched right across the country and through Rakhine State, that is going to bolster land prices. And that land is occupied by the Rohingya, or much of it. And there are pecuniary interests at stake. And the people behind those interests would like to see the Rohingya move on, and they can seize their land.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Because in 2012, when I first went to the areas in Sitwe, which is the capital where the riots broke out and the sectarian violence, there were areas where the Muslim houses had been burnt, and again, the Buddhist houses had not. And then they had been resettled in these remote IDP camps. So the land that they were on, okay, get this. Yep. A year later, the Myanmar government created a disaster management law, which states that it oversees reconstruction in areas damaged by disaster and conflict.
Right.
So the law basically enables the government to confiscate property, which in many cases was previously owned by the Rohingya residents.
Because it's been damaged.
Perfect land grab.
Yeah, yeah. So you send in the thugs. They destroy the properties, they raise them to the ground, arson attacks, forcing people off their land, and then the authorities step in and say that this land has been damaged, we're seizing control of it, and we'll take care of the redevelopment. Thank you very much.
Well, it's a perfect land grab.
Yep.
And it's going on across the country in a lot of the ethnic areas. Let's just make this clear that it's not just the Rohingya that have been stepped on by the Burmese army. It's
sure.
The Karen, the Shan, the Kachin, the Mon, the list goes on and on. But these land grabs for future development, I really think that these foreign countries that are involved with these development projects need to be held to account, or at least held partly responsible for what's going on with these conflicts within these areas.
Right.
It's devastating to the family, to the human people that are being displaced from their land so that these huge developments can occur with much of the profit leaving the country.
How do you think the United Nations ASEAN neighboring countries should act, in that they've been persistently supporting the military since the coup, not necessarily the UN, but certainly ASEAN. China has negotiated with all sides where its interests are at stake, but primarily they're all still backing Min Aung Hlaing and the military, despite the fact that they are seriously losing this conflict in the battlegrounds. And a lot of these contracts in terms of the land grabs and land development and what's being drawn up with these foreign countries, as you mentioned, unless the military can seize back that lost territory, and I don't know anybody who thinks they can, these contracts aren't going to be worth anything.
I think that's right. These areas where this development is taking place, as mentioned, that's where all the conflict is taking place as well. It's you know, follow the money, and it's happening across Myanmar.
Yep.
And I don't exactly know how the UN will move forward with this. There seems to be a lack of either focus or something that should be done to prevent this from occurring in the future. But it.
Yep.
The situation in Myanmar right now is quite complex, and I really have a hard time imagining how it will be resolved with all parties benefiting. I certainly don't see Min Aung Hlaing staying in power. I mean, he is a war criminal.
Yes, he is.
He oversaw the clearance operations in Rakhine State, and now, after the coup, they are slaughtering people across the country, whether they're an ethnic group or they are anti-junta forces that are Burmese Buddhist. The Burmese army is killing everybody that opposes their regime. So I really think that they need to be taken out of power first. And I would hope that there would be enough international attention, enough international pressure that they could do this.
Yeah.
I'm sure there must be some way that this could be resolved. Because I think Anne would agree with me, I really can't imagine Min Aung Hlaing remaining in power with his military force. They've got a lot of blood on their hands, and I really think they need to be taken to account and to be held for the atrocities they've committed across the country.
Right. Anne, what do you think?
Yeah, so what I'm saying is, with the UN or any international organization who seen the situation in Myanmar, especially in Rakhine State, they are aware what they should do, like to try to be in the mediator between the businessman from a country, from the first world country that want to invest in the Rakhine State, you know, like a China, like a South Korea, or many, many countries, including Thailand, to bring all the high businessmen who invest there already to talk and then discuss about to try to find a solution first before they start the project. So then if they can find a solution to stop people killing each other and then share the benefit to the people who live there for a long time, for decades, and everyone can have a share and have money and they can continue their life. So I think this can be one of the conclusions.
Nice thought. I just have my doubts about that, given the complexity of it. I think it's unfortunate that Myanmar seems to be ignored. It's kind of mildly understandable given the attention that the Ukraine and Gaza have been getting. But I think it's a global conflict tracker. They follow 50 conflicts currently underway around the world. And of those conflicts, they rank Myanmar as the nastiest, deadliest, and certainly the most brutal of the conflicts going on at the moment, but it just seems to be totally ignored. I suspect with the US elections not that far out and what's happening in that country, that kind of also doesn't help at all. I think Congress and quite a few US politicians have a few thoughts going on about what they'd like to do, but it's impossible to get anything done out of Washington at the moment.
Yeah, no, there are a lot of conflicts, as you say, happening across the globe, and the focus on Myanmar is on the back burner right now, and it shouldn't be. And I guess when you think about it, Myanmar junta is using, what, Russian helicopters, Ukrainian helicopters, Chinese weapons. I mean, it's disturbing to see the amount of foreign investment that continues, I think, in Myanmar. I'm not an economist by any means, but it seems like there are businesses that are thriving because of this conflict, as usual in any conflict. And that seems to be overruling any chances of resolving the issue at the moment.
Right. Going back to what Anne was saying, which I have my doubts, but I certainly applaud the idea. Given what's happening in Rakhine State, and my sources are telling me that the ethnic armed organisations and the PDFs are actually moving around Mandalay, and Mandalay, the traditional seat of monarchy and power, could well fall next. If we got to a situation where the ethnic states have to negotiate some kind of federation, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the Arakan army wants Rakhine all to itself. It does not want to be part of the federation, and there are sort of delusions of grandeur in terms of a restoration of an Arakan empire. Well, I mean, people have to fight for something. But again, where does that leave the Rohingya in Rakhine? No matter what happens, they always seem to be on the losing end.
Yeah, that's true. It seems that all groups are desperate to get out of poverty.
Right.
Okay. And the enormous amount of investment within the state, it seems that the people at the top don't want to share it with the rest of the population. And that's sort of an ongoing problem in the world, I guess. But particularly in Rakhine State, I think that there is a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment, both within the Burmese army and the general public. I think that has been going on for some time. There's a lot of toxic rhetoric that has been spewed out by the junta over the past 5-6 decades. And a lot of the average Arakan population has been listening to this. So they have been affected quite a bit by this talk of getting the they call them Bengali interlopers.
Right.
You know, they don't belong in the country. Am and I were fortunate enough, if you could use that word, to meet a anti-Muslim head monk. His name was Ashin Wuratu. This was in 2015. And he seemed like a nice guy. You know, he was very calm and cool. But when we started talking about the Rohingya situation, he sort of likened them to a savage tribe that was breeding all the time and taking over the country. I mean, his rhetoric over the most recent years led to a lot of attacks on the Muslim population, particularly the Rohingya. So sometimes it's very difficult to understand how this happens, but it's years and decades of dehumanization that has come to this analogy or this comparison of the Rohingya people to not even being human and therefore being treated as such. So right now, I think that the Rohingya population, it would be very difficult for them to resettle in Rakhine State because, as we've talked about earlier, this management law strips them of whatever land they had. And, you know, we talked to an activist years ago who said they simply had to look in the land development files and they could verify that these people had indeed lived on this land for some period of time.
Right.
But that's not going to happen. And I think that...
Yep.
I think that, yeah.
Well, they're not hardly welcomed either in the neighbourly Muslim countries in Indonesia, Malaysia, and Bangladesh. One can have some empathy for Bangladesh in terms of housing, 750,000 of them, but they're restricted to that area around Cox's Bazar, and they seem to just jump from one hellhole to another.
Yeah, I mean, the population in the Bangladesh Cox's Bazar camp, it's more than a million people. And I think that resettlement in the third country is getting increasingly difficult as well.
Indeed.
So
they're not as welcome as they once were.
I really don't know what to say. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm in Australia at the moment. I think attitudes in the West, not just here, Canada, Europe, UK, US, New Zealand, attitudes have shifted enormously. And asylum seekers, refugees, they're simply not welcomed anymore. I'll give you one example. There was a Sri Lankan refugee who had been here on a bridging visa and he still couldn't get a job. He doesn't have residency. He was 23. And he has been in Australia for 11 years since he was a kid. He arrived on a boat. He self-immolated at a skateboard park 2 weeks ago. And extraordinary that a 23-year-old man would self-immolate, set himself alight at a skateboard park. And barely got any coverage. It's kind of no one's interested. It's very difficult to find people who care, particularly in these countries where they vote and politicians are reluctant to open the gates and let people in because there's no votes in it.
Well, the empathy level on an international scale, yeah, it's gone down dramatically. And I think that the massive amount of problems that is exacerbated by the climate change, for example, is a lot of the countries are hesitant about letting more people into the country. And it's a big problem with the Rohingya population. And I believe the current leader who has been put in power in Bangladesh has mentioned about third world country resettlement. I don't know if that's going to be able to work very well either. I think they really need to solve the situation within Myanmar and get a new government in place to try to settle this situation a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are starting to run out of time, but just quickly, if there is an end to the current civil war, I doubt very much if Aung San Suu Kyi will make a comeback. I don't think the ethnic armed organisations, and even the PDF for that matter, would welcome her back as leader of Myanmar. But her government, before the civil war erupted, was criticised for ignoring the many ethnic groups, and the alleged genocide also happened on her watch. One last question. Is it possible that Myanmar can negotiate another form of government which would effectively accommodate the Rohingya?
Wow, very tough question.
Well, you know,
I think it will be very difficult for the new government, if and when it gets formed, to settle the situation regarding the Rohingya population. I'm not sure where they can go from here. I would hope that they would be able to resettle in a livable condition in Myanmar, particularly in Rakhine State, and I do believe the resources are there if they could be distributed properly within the population. I would hope that the ethnic groups would understand that all of the people deserve to be treated equally and we could resolve this matter somehow. Mm-hmm. Certainly without Min Aung Hlaing in power, I would think that it would be easier, but because, as you know, there are so many groups involved at the moment, and they're all desperately trying to work within their regions to find peace and regain power, I would think that this would be a side issue, at least immediate future, but I would hope this problem would be addressed sooner.
Yeah. So it's from my point of view, I think it might be possible, because right now you can see Myanmar, they are, it's not sad, they're fighting with all the PDF, and now they have lack of the soldier in Rakhine State, so they ask the Rohingya men to join to fight against the PDF.
Right.
So it's just some small thing. I'm not sure like a positive or a negative. But another thing is they have the party that represents the Rohingya Muslim in Burma before they banned last month.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Democracy and Human Rights Party. They just banned last month. So now they still have the member of them in the country. If Myanmar for the next election or in the future, if they want to find solution, working with the Rohingya or, you know, keep some small right for the Rohingya in their own land. I think it might be a possibility and some small table for Rohingya to talk to the Myanmar.
On that note of
junta,
on that note of slight hope, Am and Steve Sanford, authors of Witness to Genocide, Chasing the Rohingya Crisis in Southeast Asia, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Luke.